The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt, Lord of the White Claw.
And I am Sir Jimmy of House Nuts. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we are into A Storm of Swords, John 4. And also, there's some buzz on the adaptation side of things that we probably need to go over here a bit. But before we get going, Matt, how are you?
Hey, man, I am doing good. You know, you and I were just talking literally a few seconds ago before we pressed the record button here. About, you know, kind of what we were planning out as we begin to enter House of the Dragon season 2 season, I guess. You know, it's the preseason of the House of the Dragon season 2 season. And I think what we're going to do is, you know, you're going to be taking a week off here shortly. And I think what we're going to do is rewatch House of the Dragon, all 10 episodes. It will take us right into June. We don't know when in June it is releasing. My guess is it's probably closer to the beginning of June rather than the end of June, if I had to take a guess. Yeah, it's time for us to rewatch House of the Dragon. I think a lot of people have a lot of fun with that, diving back into the episodes, really taking back in the spectacle that is House of the Dragon season 1. Because, man, I've been looking up some of these clips and stuff when I've been working on some of our TikToks and stuff like that, and man, you're like, wow, there's some awesome moments in that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that we were getting hyped up week to week and coming on after the episodes, like right after them, and screaming and then calming down and then trying to do a little bit more with it during the week. So the thing is I was like, well, man, do I really need to rewatch it? But now you think about it, it's been almost 2 years. It would have been 2 years in August or September. September is your anniversary for your wedding, right?
Yes.
Because we were at your wedding on episode right. 2 or 3.
I think it was episode 3.
Yeah, I think it was episode 3. So it's been almost 2 years. Crazy. And I know that I've forgotten little things, and I'm sure there's little things we'll pick up on that are probably going to hint towards things of season 2, and also the changes right from the book that we need to keep ourselves fresh with, because I know in my head, I think a lot about like the book history. So I need to get caught up or, you know, realign with the TV canon so that whenever season 2 comes around, I know exactly what's going on. But I think a rewatch is well worth it. I just saw Dune 2, which by the way was fantastic, and
I'm going tonight,
dude. People listen, I used to love movie theaters. I don't love them as much anymore. I've had multiple movies in the last like 5-6 years ruined for me because of audiences at the theaters. Like, people just can't seem to focus on the screen. Like Oppenheimer had someone talking. I went to see Talk to Me from A24 and I had people yelling in the movie. Like, it was just like, man,
yeah,
this is hard to go to the theater. Dune is worth it. If you're someone who's like, I don't want to go to the theater to see Dune 2. I'm telling you, it was a out of body experience. You know, it reminds me of Lord of the Rings again in theaters. It's incredible.
Did you go to an AMC theater and did you see people with the popcorn bucket?
So I did go to the AMC theater. I went to IMAX. And obviously, I recommend IMAX if you can. I know it's not around everyone, but I did not have any. But I tried to get the damn bucket, and they didn't have one. And I was so
they were out.
I was ready, to go, but they said, you know, they didn't have any. And honestly, the person acted like they didn't know what I was talking about, so they probably sitting in a box in the back or something. You know what I mean? Like, they thought the adult mart had sent the wrong box. But man. I only regret about Dune 2 is that I didn't watch Dune 1 first, because there were callbacks to the first one, like specific combat things that Paul learns and all kinds of other stuff. And I just think if you take Dune 1 and Dune 2 as one big movie, it's a masterpiece. And I think that doing this rewatch into House of Dragon season two is going to make season two even better, because we're going to look at it, you know, finishing right when season two comes out, it's going to feel like one big show to us.
Yeah, I agree. And there's so many things too. You know, I was thinking about like theories that when, you know, we did a big episode like House of the Dragon Iceberg, where we went over all the stuff from season one, like tying in some of those theories and stuff. And I think there are some of those theories that might get explored further in season two. The books paint Allison like she is the complete and total villain of the whole thing.
Yeah, we're like seeing more of an in-the-moment rendition rather than a historical take where she is painted very poorly by the narrator.
Right, and in the show, it's much more like a lot of these things are happening to her. She's somewhat more of a victim, and it's just a totally different way that it's done. But there, in the books, you know, Allison is like there sort of serving King Jaehaerys when he dies, right? And so... I don't know. I'm not saying that she did or anything, but it's just something that I could see come up. Like it could be like a passing line of like, oh, weren't you also there for another king's suspicious death? You know, like there's stuff like that that could get explored a little bit further in
and new House theories.
Yeah, exactly. And House of the Dragon season two, we've still got stuff with Laris and
time travel and burn down right. Summer Hall. You know, is he a time traveler?
Right. Yeah. All of the feet stuff. You know, there's so much more that it's going to explore, and it's going to be a lot of fun too to kind of revisit some of those things. So yeah, I'm very much
is whatever we went over the Drogon. No,
oh my god, yeah. Daenerys didn't do anything wrong. Hey man, do the dragon. By the way, we just posted a TikTok about that. Like I just posted one from a conversation we had a couple weeks ago about like how dragons controlling people, and man, it blew up. All so like it,
or do they hate
people?
Me?
So people definitely want us to talk a little bit more about it. But that's another thing that House of the Dragon is exploring further, is the connection between the dragons and the dragon riders. Because in Game of Thrones, it's just Daenerys. I mean, Jon rides one. And then I guess, you know, obviously the Night King does too. But here we have all these different people riding dragons. So it's definitely like giving us more insight to magic that Game of Thrones didn't have the opportunity to give us. So it's definitely a lot of fun. So with that, Jimmy, we got a little bit of news today. So first of all, Warner Brothers Games came out and said some pretty interesting things about some of the upcoming games that they want to make and look at, you know, their intellectual properties, one of which, and the first thing they said was Game of Thrones. So, you know, they said, hey, we want to essentially look at all of our big industry, all of our big franchises. And the first one they said is Game of Thrones. So to me, that means whether consciously or subconsciously, the head of Warner Brothers Games thinks that Game of Thrones is Warner Brothers' single biggest franchise, which is interesting when you consider you also have Harry Potter and DC and then Mortal Kombat, obviously on the game side, even though they do make terrible movies for that franchise, but they also make terrible games too, so there's that as well. But so last year, Jimmy, and this is why Warner Brothers Games are complete morons, and the last thing I trust them with is Game of Thrones, and this does not get me excited whatsoever. So last year, Warner Brothers made Hogwarts Legacy, an amazing, excellent single-player adventure that came out in a time in which it was heavily trying to be canceled online because of obviously the ties of J.K. Rowling. She's very, you know, like anti-transgender, the Harry Potter community, very pro, you know, that. And so there was like everything before the game released was nothing but people trying to essentially cancel that game. And it ended up selling 22 million copies and was the best-selling game of last year. And now you have Warner Brothers saying, you know what? We do want to really make a lot more video games, but we think we should focus on live service multiplayer games, which is what they just released with Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League, which is already by far easily the worst game of this year and has less than 1,000 people playing on it. And it's not even 2 months old.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing about the video game industry. A lot of it sucks. So I don't have high hopes, but hey, a shot is at least something. Like, because we've always, me and you are huge nerds, and we want an RPG for A Song of Ice and Fire, obviously. That's not a mod to some other amazing game. Like, we want an actual Westeros built game that, you know, doesn't have horrible combat or whatever. So at least it's a shot. But with them saying that, oh yeah, we want to do this live service stuff, I don't know, man. I don't know.
I mean, a Game of Thrones video game to me seems so simple. You just make it like Shadow of Mordor, or you make it like, you know, like Assassin's Creed. It's like that style of a game. And you just make it about some Night's Watch Ranger set in the past who doesn't have to interfere with any of the main stories. And he can, you know, go ranging. You can fight wildlings. You can uncover the secret. Give us some more depth into the White Walkers. Like, that seems easy. You want to set it in King's Landing and just make it like an RPG? You do that too. But if it's going to be like a live service multiplayer game, I don't know. It just seems like I can't even think of anything that at all would make me, or I think also the video game fans, that interested when it comes to like Game of Thrones. It's just like maybe something like the game For Honor, which is where you, that, you know, they did like Vikings versus Knights versus Samurai. And here's maybe that. You do something like that where it's like a big battlefield and it's Lannisters, Stark, you know, but then it's just not, then it's like not accurate.
It's going to be a Facebook game, just so you know.
Probably. That's all they do for Game of Thrones. It makes no sense.
I think the audience is people who play those games. I think a lot of people who enjoyed Game of Thrones are a bit older, maybe not big gamers. And they have to be getting some feedback to do that, right? Like, they're not just randomly investing all these millions of dollars to do these things. So I think in their focus groups, it's probably a lot of, you know, middle-aged people who are hanging out on their mobile phone playing games or Facebook or whatever. So,
and that's why they decide. But yeah. I mean it's just so interesting when you have like the, hey, we're gonna make superhero video games, but hey, we can target those towards kids. But apparently Game of Thrones, you just don't I want think, like it lends itself so well.
It does, but I just feel they think the audience is someone totally different, and it might be, like, I don't know. I really don't know the demographic for Game of Thrones television.
I would say probably 30 and up.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, they've made games for everything else in the list of things that they talked about. But it is interesting that they did say Game of Thrones, and we've yet to see a big AAA Game of Thrones game. I mean, the last big Game of Thrones game was probably that Game of Thrones RPG that was awful.
Or Telltale. I mean, they were
pretty, right. Yeah, they were pretty close.
It was fun. But
yeah,
it's okay.
So we'll see. Hopefully we end up getting one. I don't really trust Warner Brothers games pretty much anymore. it's such a shame considering last year they made the biggest game of the year. Right. And then, you know, they released, you know, Barbie, which did well. And they just released Dune, which did well. But still, as a company, or with Warner Brothers, are kind of like, I don't know, you know.
Like, yeah, I mean, we'll see. Hey, who knows? Maybe they will go the way of whatever the Potter game was, and that'll, you know, be the way they take that. Who knows? We can hope. Yeah,
we certainly can. So, all right, we have a little bit of news from, you know, one of the bigger Westeros Twitter folk out there, Westerosis, saying a Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, the Hedge Knight, is currently listed as Dunkin' Egg. And has a writer's room that consists of Sean Conrad, Hiriam Martinez, Annie Wyman, Aziza Barnes, and Ty Mickle. Some of those names sound somewhat familiar. Perfect.
Yeah, yeah. So when I saw this, I immediately got concerned because Ryan Condell's name wasn't on the list. And I said, oh my God, oh no, the sky's falling. because I'm not super aware of other writers in Hollywood, other than if they, like, you know, George has mentioned them. I usually don't know them very, very well. Mm-hmm. First off, it sounds like the show name might end up being Dunkin' Egg, which is kind of cool. I think the Hedge Knight is really good, but I also wonder if it's a little too generic and Dunkin' Egg has a little bit more flavor to it. Possibly. I don't know.
I can see that.
But so the very first thing I want to say is I think we're okay, because Ty Mickle is someone who has been working with George for over 10 years. and did not only did a lot of early Game of Thrones episodes, which but also worked on House of the Dragon. They brought Ty Mickle in for all 10 episodes in 2022, and he wrote 8 episodes between 2011 and 2012 for Game of Thrones, which I think even people who turned on the show earlier than season 7 or 8 can say that season 1 and 2 are fantastically written. So the good news is I think that this is the lead writer that is going to be leading the effort, and it makes a whole lot of sense whenever you look at their track record. They also worked on Attack of the Show, which I know some people really enjoyed that as well, but seems like somebody that is kind of branching off House of the Dragon, getting a little bit more responsibility, and I assume has a pretty good relationship with George R. R. Martin. And it has been around since the 2011 in the Game of Thrones universe. So that is fantastic. The other writers, there is one that is very well known, and that is Steve Conrad. Steve Conrad worked on Patriot. He worked on Wonder, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, Pursuit of Happiness with Will
Smith.
Great
movie. That's such a good movie.
Yes. And actually a movie that I like that I know some other people don't is The Weatherman. He also worked on that. So this is somebody who's been around a long time and has done some pretty good work. Then you have Hiram Martinez, who helped with Get Shorty, Snowfall, Snowpiercer television series. And then you have Annie Julia, who worked at Welcome to Chippendales, Tokyo Vice, and The Chair, which I heard good things about Tokyo Vice. And then somebody else who also worked on Snowfall is a part of the crew, and that is Aziza Barnes. And they have a little bit less experience, it would seem, but the stuff that they have worked on has been highly rated. So I think you can say that Ty Mickle and Steve Conrad are most likely the veteran writers of the show, lead writers. And then you're going to have these other talented younger people underneath them. So I'm very encouraged by this as someone who is always worried of what's going to happen in the writer's room, because that's where, you know, shows are lost or won. I think that Ty Mickle being involved is a really good sign.
Yeah. You know, also taking a look at this by the way, so far there's 5 writers, which would tell me there's at minimum 5 episodes, you would imagine, unless obviously there might be some co-writing, but typically the way it works is each person kind of gets to do at least 1 episode. Mm-hmm. So that tells me on what you could have, everybody could get 2 episodes. You could have a season of 10, or somebody's perhaps writing 2, which is my guess. And it's going to be a season of 6.
Yeah, I mean, they've said that it's going to be a season of 6, right? So I imagine Ty Mickle and Steve Conrad are going to be writing on pretty much every single episode, and then having people kind of jump in. I mean, we'll see. I think this show is going to be a bit different from anything else that we've seen out of Westeros TV. Yeah,
very much.
Because of the nature of it, like one in tone, but also in structure. It's a short story. So, well, I should say a novella. But it's going to be interesting to see if they kind of continue some of the things we know, like the penultimate episode being the biggest of the season. Like, is that something they're going to continue in Duncan Egg? I don't know. Let's see.
Yeah, and it really doesn't have that many battles, but you will see jousting and stuff like that. Then of course there is one final pretty cool battle. I mean, it's seven on seven. Yeah. It's certainly not to the scale of like the battle at the wall or battle of Winterfell
it's epic in its own right. And I think by that point we have had built sympathy and empathy for Dunk and what he's going through. And then Egg's kind of an interesting little tie to the Targaryens. And then you end up having, you know, this fight. And we've never really seen a 7-on-7 or anything like this on TV yet. So it's fresh. It's new. I think it's going to have a lot of drama in the fight. And then we all know that the ending point is, you know, major. So,
yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, the other thing that will be interesting is there is a little bit of mysticism in Duncan Egg, at least like even the Hedge Knight, there is still some green dream or, you know, dragon dreams that are explored a little bit, and prophecy and sort of, you know, visions and stuff like that. So like, yeah, certainly a little bit. And, you know, like, hey, we're going to see Darren, you know, has the dream of Dunk killing a dragon. And then we end up seeing what happens at the end, where he obviously doesn't kill an actual physical dragon, but it'll be kind of, ooh, and in some ways it's going to come kind of true. And I think that in itself, because it'll be it's a very close thing, right? You know, it's unlike a lot of the stuff in Game of Thrones where, Quaithe comes and tells Dany this vision and dream and everything, and then Quaithe leaves and we never see her again, and we kind of forget what it's all about. Whereas in House of the Dragon, whereas in with a Duncan Egg, excuse me, we're gonna have this dragon dream, and then it's going to go that way. And then in season two, we might get a little about Arian Brightflame, who went over to Essos, and we heard that he tried to drink wildfire to become a dragon, and it didn't go well for him. So this is Duncan Egg is a good place to have a show that can help expand Westeros.
Yeah, it's also super tight, which is great. Like, there's not a lot of meandering in the Duncan Egg stories, because whenever you're going with a shorter form of writing or narrative, you have to make every single word count. Like, you actually are working with restrictions, and the really great short fiction always flexes. Like, literally every single sentence has a purpose, can tie to other sentences, is thematically congruent with everything else. So I think that there's an opportunity for this show, out of everything, to feel the tightest and the most worthwhile, where you'll go back and go to season one and be like, this tied into or even episode one. We'll start small. Episode one to episode six, you see a reason for the lines of dialogue and the connections, right? Like the dragon dreams. So you don't have a Quaithe falling off by season seven and eight, where we don't even know what the hell that was all about. Right. You will have answers to that, because it's a lot smaller scope. And it's a little bit more practical, I think, to pay off some of those things. So I think it's going to be great. I think it's an opportunity for it to be an absolute home run, even for people who maybe find, there's a lot of people who find Game of Thrones a bit boring. I've heard that criticism before. Obviously, it's a super popular show, but there are people, oh my God, all they do is talk.
They need more action.
Yeah, this show, is going to be a little bit more condensed and tight. So I think it's going to find a whole new audience, which is great. And it's also going to be a benefit to people who might be a little bit squeamish, who have not been able to get into the shows because of the sexual content / violence. HBO will most likely add some of that in, because that's kind of what they do. And well, honestly, it also sells very well. But this show does have the opportunity to just be slightly less violent or, sexual in nature, so it could attract a whole new audience. I think it's great.
Yeah, I agree. And I was thinking about that, just what you said there too, with like the balancing of talking about, like, a lot of people find Game of Thrones boring. Rethink about House of the Dragon as well. Is there's the combat is much more balanced in that show, and I think it'll be even more balanced in Duncan Egg, just because it's at a tournament, so you can always show, like, do just like establishing shots of, hey, this like fight's going on in the background while people are talking and stuff like that. So it's essentially the whole thing it takes place at a tournament.
Yeah, and seeing like the tents and him trying to go and find money for his armor, like, that's a great episode in itself. Like, it's gonna be a lot of fun. Tansy Tutal is gonna be there. I can't wait. Let's go.
Yeah, I think I also think some of the other things they'll explore in that show is, I think they will explore in season one the history of Blackfyre Rebellion, since it wasn't that long ago. I think they'll bring some of that stuff forward a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a big issue, right, in Westeros at the time. It's still talked about. There's still people who have loyalties. Things aren't as ironed out as maybe the history books would like us to believe. So, I think the Blackfyre Rebellion is going to be a big piece of the Duncan Egg show.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jimmy, with that, let's dive over to our chapter, very short chapter today. Yeah. And this is John 4 here. So John is watching as Jarl's men are competing with the Magnar to see who will reach the top of the wall first. Many of the climbers fall to their death, including Jarl, but several eventually reach the top. As long rope ladders are dropped down to the base to allow the others to climb, John notices Ygritte with tears in her eyes. She tells him that they never found the Horn of Jormungandr, which would have helped them bring the wall down without a fight.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's a very, very short chapter today. So glad we were able to get some news in here. But I'll just start here and read a little bit of the first passage here. So Ghost was gone when the wildlings led their horses from the cave. Did he understand about Castle Black? John took a breath of the crisp morning air and allowed himself to hope. The eastern sky was pink near the horizon and pale gray higher up. The Sword of the Morning still hung in the south, the bright white star in its hilt blazing like a diamond in the dawn, but the blacks and grays of the darkling forest were turning once again to greens and golds, reds and russets. And above the soldier pines and oaks and ash and sentinels stood the wall, the ice pale and glimmering beneath the dust and dirt of the pocket of that pocketed its surface. So very, very heavily House Dane imagery there. Not only are they looking at the constellation of the Sword of the Morning, but the House Dane's colors, which are also pink and gray. And then, of course, its bright white star and its hilt blazing like a diamond in the dawn, right? So it's like, you know, it's like a shining star in the dawn, very, you know, very heavily implying House Dane imagery there.
Yeah, certainly a call to that, and it raises our ears for the suspicion that, you know, maybe John is a Sword of the Morning. And, you know, also Corn Halfhand is echoed in this chapter, because remember, this is the mission that he has sent him on, and a lot of people like the idea that he's Arthur Dane. There's a lot of echoes in this chapter for how short it is. There's also a lot more questions posed, I think, in this chapter than there are answers to anything, and that's due to the fact that John, in this chapter, as our protagonist, is viewing. He is kind of passively observing and making comments on the wall, on the wildlings, the history of how they got there, why they're there, and then also the Night's Watch's defenses, which kind of gives us a clue about how the Night's Watch are dealing with the fact that, one, they don't have as many people as they used to, but also they have crumbling infrastructure. And they're trying to use that to their advantage to kind of funnel people in and out, you know, of these areas so that they can basically, you know, put them in a barrel and shoot them. So it is a short chapter, but I think it's kind of cool. And also anything about the Horn of Winter is always going to pique my interest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And back to the House Dane thing real quick. If that was the only thing we had heard about it in this John is North of the Wall mm-hmm. business, then it would just be, oh, that's just a fun little tie-in way to him yeah. do it. But the thing that raises all the question is it's mentioned in just about every chapter in which John, like post John Corn Halfhand, him with a grat and everything, like it's every single second of it, you know, is there as well. And, you know, it could just be simply if John, of course, isn't actually a Dane, which and he potentially could be, right? He could be Ned and Ashara, which is the second most popular theory behind Lyanna and Rhaegar, of course. It could just be George trying to actually play with people and mess them up to think that that's a thing. Or, you know, it could also be that a lot of this imagery is happening. The John being tied to the Sword of Mourning imagery is happening in which John is forsaking his vows with Ygritte.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is, if you want to view that with a tie to the Dane, would potentially still be Ned and Ashara, who Ned did love Ashara.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I like that a little bit more. I've always thought that George was kind of messing us with Ned and Ashara. And I used to say, I need to know what happened there. But you know what? The story is about Jon Snow in a lot of ways. And I think it's more to add to the mystery of his parentage. I think one of the things that's interesting is like George poses the question to Dan and Dave when they're doing the show, like, who's Jon Snow's real parents? And they answered. But so many people, I think, legitimately read these books and they just accept that Ned is his dad. Like, they don't even question it. They're like, wait, what do you mean his parents might not be?
Oh, I know.
You know, and one, I think that might unfortunately make a commentary on how people read nowadays. But two, it's clear that George wanted this to be a question in the reader's head as they went through. It actually wasn't supposed to be this big, like, whoa moment as far as like we didn't know that there was something up. I think he wanted you to be guessing this entire time and maybe even nudging us towards Ashara Dane at this point.
Could be. Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just Jon Snow is my favorite character. There's all the things going on. And I was just like, what's the deal with this mom? Because very early on, it's the, hey, like, you know, we'll talk about it. Like thing, right? And it's okay, then that is the thing that sets the stage for this is like then, because then Ned dies, right? When Ned dies, the secret of John, and it's like now we're never gonna learn that. So I mean, that is the key to like obviously the whole story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure is. Yeah. And also it's like this sad tale, right, of two people who loved one another, and just like the layers to this thing. So not only is it a secret, but also the narrative is that Rhaegar, you know, obviously abused Lyanna and she got kidnapped, you know what I'm saying? And it actually is none of this. from what we think, right? We think that they were actually interested in one another, maybe possibly in love, and Robert was actually the bad guy.
Right.
Robert killed Prince Charming. It's just like, when you think about all that, you're like, God, it really does revolve around John. So that's kind of why I think we may never get any Ashara Dane and Ned Stark confirmation or answers, because truly what it's about, I think, is to make us ponder Jon Snow's parentage. And you know, we can assume that there was something between Ned and Ashara Dane, and whether or not they ever, you know, had a kid or something. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe we won't. I don't know. I would be okay right. with it going unanswered, but I don't know. Ashara Dane died and we never got a body. So that's always right. a big eyebrow raiser in fantasy books.
That's something you and I have never really talked about.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think
I don't think you and I have ever really talked about, like, is Septa Lamor Ashara Dane?
Yeah, we might have to do the deep dive. Part of it's because a lot of those sections in Dance with Dragons are not as fresh in my mind as something like A Storm of Swords is. Right. So I've been kind of waiting. I mean, obviously it's going to take us a while to get there, but like, I've been kind of waiting to reread those and really close reading the sentences to see if we can pick out anything that hints. I mean, I think it's pretty clear from what I remember of the, I don't know, probably four or five times I've read the book, that Lamora had a child. Like, there's no doubt right. that it had a child.
Yeah.
And everyone on this boat is someone they're not. And right. and Lamora just isn't just some random person, right?
And that's something I've never really explored too, is the idea of like, well, because it's just because I do not fall into the Ned plus Ashara camp at all. I mean, the Ned plus Ashara could have happened, but I don't think Ned plus Ashara equals John.
I don't agree.
Right. But I guess in theory, if you want to go down, like, you know, some double, triple theory levels here, some serious icebergs in which all these things have to connect in order for other theories to be feasible. I mean, if you want to go down that route, then I suppose Septa Lamor could at some point meet John and give him and he could meet his mother.
Right. You're saying if R plus L equals J, we're not true. It opens up the idea that Lamora could be his actual mom.
Could be. Yeah. Meeting,
and then she's sitting there looking at young Griff that's supposed to be Aegon and actually looking at a Targaryen descent. Yeah. I mean, that is interesting. Like, I will say this, like, I'm right. not on board with the theory, but I'll be damned if that's not compelling as hell. And
right.
a totally new angle I've never really thought about, to be honest.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things is sometimes when you begin to dive into all of these Game of Thrones, you know, Song of Ice and Fire theories is, it's like those things where it's like
the future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Football, or it's like a football and a basketball are both a ball, but only one of them can be a football. You know what I mean? It's like if X plus Y equals, you know, is true, then whatever, you want to go down those things. Because like Benjen, like he mentions Benjen here too, but Benjen is somebody who we've said we don't think is cold hands in the books is very going to be very different than the show. So I think Benjen still has some role to play. Benjen could be the one to tell John of his parentage, whether it's Ned plus Ashara or R plus L equals J. I do think Benjen is going to come back at some point too. And whether it's John that meets him or Bran that meets him, I do think he is going to have a role to play, but I'll dive back into here to the chapter, because he does mention Benjen. And again, this is a really short chapter, but we do get a little bit of like history on the wall and stuff as well.
Yeah, and so, I got a question for you.
Go ahead. So the wall was often said to stand 700 feet, but Jarl had found a place where it was both higher and lower. Before them, the ice rose sheer from out of the trees like some immense cliff, crowned by wind-carved battlements that loomed at least 800 feet high, perhaps 900 in spots. But that was deceptive. John realized as they drew closer, Brandon the Builder had laid his huge foundation blocks along the heights wherever feasible, and hereabouts the hill rose wild and rugged. He had once heard his uncle Benjen say that the wall was a sword east of Castle Black, but a snake to the west. It was true. Sweeping in over one huge humped hill, the ice dipped down into a valley, climbed the knife edge of a long granite ridgeline for a league or more, ran along a jagged crest, dipped again into a valley deeper still, and then rose higher and higher, leaping from hill to hill as far as the eye could see into the mountains out west.
Yeah, some pretty excellent imagery here. And just like the wall in itself having so much like mystique, but also epicness. And it's like this big magical barrier that like we kind of just take for granted, like when we talk about the series and like, yeah, it's a low fantasy series that revolves around like politics. Oh, but there is this massive magical boundary in the north that's keeping zombies out. Like, you know what I mean?
It's and dragons.
And dragons. That's right. Yeah.
So, dragons don't want to go over the wall.
Yeah, we have long overlooked the wall and its creation.
I know.
Me and you have talked about when it was built. Like we did go into that when we talked to, in the World of Ice and
Fire. We did a little World of Ice and Fire recap. Built
and how?
It's not clear. And that's the crazy the craziest thing about it, because you would think that the wall was built after you but then that doesn't make sense either. It's like, it seems like you would want to make the wall to keep the White Walkers out. But if you make it after you've beaten them, then what's the point? But if you make it before you've beaten them, then how do they get to a point where you have to go beat them?
There's certainly a possibility that they built the wall after the battle, knowing that it was going to reoccur, that they knew this was going to be a cycle and that they had to come back. That is totally possible, and I would accept that. But it just feels like there's a big piece of information missing from that history, does it not?
It does. Let me, you know, I'm grabbing my, I got my book here in front of me, because
not the good book,
the big book, right?
The big one.
The world of, it is honestly, it's like my favorite thing, because it talks about the giants, right? And literally, the Dawn Age is like the most intriguing thing in this entire book, World of Ice and Fire, and it's the whole thing is so vague, like it doesn't make sense given what we know, because it's the Long Night starts after the Age of Heroes, after Garth Greenhand and all the people who probably were just regular people but have been in, I mean, maybe they were more magical, we don't know, but maybe they've been fantasized. It's kind of like how King Arthur, they think, was something like never even existed, but it was just sort of like a combination of, he definitely existed. I know Excalibur there. You'll never ever persuade me that King Arthur did not exist, but you know, that's at least what they, you know, what they say and everything. But yeah, I mean, it's the whole thing is crazy, just because the timing, it just doesn't, like, so much of the timing just doesn't add up.
Well, the timeline isn't super rigid. Like the folks, you know, in the in-world narrators that are writing down this World of Ice and Fire, they're not super concerned with that. They're more so concerned with the way that Westeros ended up being shaped and the events that got us to the present day, right? Like, that's kind of what it is. And fair enough. I mean, a lot of history's timelines can be very confusing, and, you know, we're always learning more stuff about it. What we are reading is a time and place in Westeros written by somebody who has the information to do at the time. So...
yeah. So, okay. So here, real quick, just in the World of Ice and Fire, in the Dawn Age, it says there's a passage here. So this is before the Long Night takes place, right? It's talking about the giants, and it's saying, this is a maester again, who's telling this. He says, it's long been held that they did this for protection from predators such as direwolves or shadow cats with their simple stone weapons, and even their vaunted green seers were not proof against. But other sources dispute this, stating that their greatest foes were the giants. This is talking about the children. Children of the forest were fighting against the giants, and that they held out inside like bogs, by the way, which means something in marshlands, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Chronicman magic might actually be children magic. They might be closer essentially than we think, which would also explain why Howland Reed was actually able to get to the Isle of Faces, if he has that sort of blood. Children, maybe he has children's blood in him. So
he was small in stature.
But as you continue, just real here, it says, But other sources dispute this, stating their greatest foes were the giants, as hinted in the tales told of the North, and as possibly proved by Maester Kennet in the study of Barrow near the Long Lake, a giant's burial with obsidian arrowheads found amidst its ribs. It brings to mind the transcription of a wildling song in Maester Herrick's History of Kings Beyond the Wall. So that would imply that if there was something similar that happened, it would have tapped. There's kings beyond the wall, which means the wall would already have to be built.
Yeah, and then that's where, like, we get confused. That's,
I know, it doesn't, it doesn't, it doesn't, it doesn't, yeah, it, they jump around a lot, unfortunately, in World of Ice and Fire, and so it's hard to tell exactly when and where things are happening. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's somebody out there who's probably trying to pin down the timeline, and we're just not aware, so maybe I should do a little bit more research into that. But also just the forming of the wall, right? And who did it? And Ygritte says it's blood in this chapter. She said it's blood magic, and I'm inclined to kind of believe her because of the magical properties, and we do know blood magic seems to be something that is legitimate, right? Like,
right.
Who is granting that power? We're not sure. We don't know if it's R'hllor or some other god, and they just gave it a name, but blood does seem to matter in the Fantastic Realms of the series.
So. Yeah, King's blood has seemed to matter. Blood magic has seemed to do things. And that's another thing too. We've talked about too is, like, King's blood and blood magic might be the same thing, but it's just the people think that, oh, there's like a king involved, and suddenly there's more power to it, right? Like,
yeah,
because Stannis should be the rightful king, right? Should be
true king.
You would imagine then Stannis King's blood would have actual power, since he is the one true king of Westeros, regardless of everything else that's going. But then you know, obviously in the show, she gets blood from Gendry. What's like, well, Gendry's Robert, so there's, you know,
yeah.
So it just seems like you can just pick and choose for King's blood.
Yeah, and who's to say that all the King's blood prior, maybe like it was just Targaryen blood, like maybe Targaryen.
Right.
Blood.
And if you just declare yourself king, are you just suddenly?
Yeah, who's keeping track? Who's auditing
exactly
things is what I need right to know.
Mira Mazder takes Danny's blood.
Or is it a lie that it has to be King's blood? Maybe it's just blood in general.
Right.
And we're seeing
Danny could have King's blood.
Yeah, we're seeing it through that classism lens that it's only these nobles' blood that matters.
Right.
That would kind of
does Balon Greyjoy calls himself a king? Is his blood suddenly king's blood?
Well, it's splattered on the rocks from the drawbridge, so
right,
we'll never know. It got washed out.
Yeah. So okay. Did you already ask me your question? We just kind of went on a big
thing. Well, I mean, this kind of goes into the end of the chapter, but honestly, I do think it's a good time, and I can even read
that's fine,
this
yeah part.
Okay, so we get all the stuff about the wall. Right. Ygritte watched them struggle for a while. I hate this wall, she said it in a low, angry voice. Can you feel how cold it is? It's made of ice, John pointed out. Nor had it. You know nothing, Jon Snow. This wall is made of blood. And this is one of my favorite paragraphs in this chapter. Nor had it drunk its fill. By sunset, two of the Thens had fallen from the ladder to their deaths, but they were the last. It was near midnight before John reached the top. The stars were out again, and Ygritte was trembling from the climb. I almost fell, she said, with tears in her eyes. Twice, thrice, the wall was trying to shake me off. I could feel it. And I just love that, like, nor had it drink its fill, and talking about blood. Yeah. Like, it's just, you know, it's creepy almost. And then to feel like you're climbing this insurmountable wall, like, it's already a really big task. And in Ygritte's head, she believes this wall was, like, alive and trying to shake her off. And it's just like, that would be terrifying, right? I think she's trembling from exhaustion, but also, you know, John says it's from the climb, but I think she's scared. I don't think it's just exhaustion. But here's the thing. She continues to cry, and John wants to know why she's crying. And she says this, I'm crying because we never found the Horn of Winter. We opened up 50 graves and let all those shades loose in the world and never found the Horn of Yoramon to bring this cold thing down. The obvious question is, well, where's the Horn of Winter? But I got a bigger question for you, Matt. When they were going through these graves that they found, first, whose graves? We're not sure. But they let shades out into the world. Is it possible that in this hunt for the Horn of Winter, that they are the ones who awoke the White Walkers?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, we know that there's some White Walkers that are already out.
Mm-hmm.
Could they have awoken somebody more powerful, like a Night King or something like that. I would say so, because, and the idea of like shades and ghosts, you know, like ghosts are mentioned in this world, but they're never, we don't really ever see them like we do in like obviously other media where, right? Yeah. Like, you know, but like when we think of ghosts, it's like, hey, did you see your lights flickering or something kind of weird? That could be a ghost, right? Yeah. But we don't, but ghosts themselves aren't really a thing in this universe. The only thing we get close to is like the shadow baby that Melisandre lets out. I would say that's really the closest thing to a ghost. Obviously they think there are ghosts, like the goat, there's the song by Jenny Song, High in the Hall of the Kings, you know, the ghost, the ghost of
Heron Hall, right?
The ghost of Heron Hall, John's dog, yeah, right,
that's right.
So ghosts, they still think there are ghosts and spirits and demons and all, whatever. Yeah, I'm sure all of those types of things. So, I mean, is it possible that they let something out that's going to some evil out or something? Absolutely. Keep in mind, they are also opening as many graves as they can say. What's to say that some of those graves didn't contain people who were powerful in magic, and, you know, curses and some of those things might exist. I mean, it seems like Danny might be cursed by Amir Mazdar. So it's just another level of mysticism that we haven't really explored. Like, it's so funny in this universe, because anytime I bring up some of like the crazy theories, you know, like, oh, is Roose Bolton a vampire? Right. Is this thing? It's like one of those things where you just sort of laugh it off. And this is what George has done extremely well, is George has shown you magic in places where it makes sense, which when you dive into the books and you're trying to dive through the theories, makes other places almost seem laughable because it makes it seem real. Like, he's done this incredible balance of like realism with actually showing you legitimate magic in another thing, to where you kind of like separate the two. You're like, yeah, no way. But the real quick, the Boltons, like, just on that theory, because I think, you know, it's one that I think is kind of funny in a way. It's like people look at the idea of like him being a vampire and they're like, that's, what a joke. Like, no, that's obviously not a thing. Their House Sigil is literally cutting people's skins off. And there's quite literally a group that Arya Stark is involved with, which whole deal is they wear the faces of people and like can magically disguise themselves.
And George R. R. Martin wrote a vampire horror novel, and where he describes the vampires in that book, very similar to how he describes, he uses some similar adjectives and words that he used to describe Joshua the vampire to Roose Bolton in A Song of Ice and Fire. And A Song of Ice and Fire was written after. I'm just saying that there could be, but you're right. He does an amazing job of making us feel connected to this world that like it's something that could have happened in our world. Like, it's an alternate history almost. And when we think about history, like, a lot of people have fun thinking about the mysticism of the past, right? And you have ancient aliens and all this crazy stuff, right? But the reason why it's so intriguing to us is because it feels like a real place and time that we're not so sure about. And he has done such an amazing job of taking like myth and fable and mysticism and then making it feel like it's attached to this low fantasy world. Like, we would think King's Landing would have zero magic, but in Essos, who knows, right? Like, there's this huge divide, and we seem to just kind of accept it. It's something else. But curses, Matt, you're right. Danny is cursed. I would say I feel like she is definitely cursed, honestly.
Well, she gives her a curse, and she gives her exactly what she has to do in order to break it. Yeah. Be like, I mean, she says, you know, when the sun sets in the east and, you know, all those things, which is basically, you know, the opposite of the way the world works, essentially. You know, I mean, that's what basically what Mira Mazdar says, like, only then can you, you know, bear a child. And so that is, in a way, it's a curse. And so it is interesting to think about the idea of, yes, they were digging up all of these graves, and we hear all the time about, well, kinslaying is bad, and then we see bad things happen. Right.
Yeah.
Theon Greyjoy might actually be part of that, because if you know, Theon says he slept with that innkeeper woman, and we know that he ends up killing those stable boys, and you kind of look at it, the ages line up, might be his kid, and then that's why he goes through everything he goes through, because everyone always says kinslaying is like the single worst thing you can do.
Yes. And One of the reasons,
I mean, across cultures, across religions, like everyone in this world, like the white, like the wildlings talk about it, like north, south, it doesn't matter. Free folk. Exactly. Exactly. But they all say kinslaying is bad.
Well, it's one thing that is consistent across all cultures is that you do have kin. And right. It would appear that in a survival mindset that the kin are the people that you're going to rely on the most. So, of course, murdering them is one of the worst things that you could possibly do. It's a betrayal that transcends cultures, languages, locations. It is something about the individual and the person. And that's why in our world also, kinslaying is pretty much unanimously considered pretty horrible with very few exceptions. So I want to say this, though. The thing that I love about A Song of Ice and Fire is that you can also always look at it from a more skeptical lens, because we see magical things that are proposed to us as magical that are not, right? Or a switching of expectations. Like when Sansa has that prophetic vision of a giant stomping through Winterfell and ends up being Sweet Robin stomping on her snow castle in A Dance of Dragons. And you're like, ah, okay. That actually fulfills the prophecy. That's very interesting. So, for instance, Dany's curse. Who's to say that the inbred family tree has not just led her to end up, you know, being unable to have children? Or maybe she can't have children. Maybe it's Drogo's fault. You know, so maybe she's not cursed. See, it's fun that I can play both sides of this. And here's, I'm gonna bring this back to us, you and I, in our conversation. So we've talked about how the White Walkers are most likely, we believe that the White Walkers have their own culture, they're their own species, and that they have been existing up in the north, and they are an extension of human beings rather than just mindless zombies, okay? What if these graves belong to those people, and it is such a transgression in their culture to do something like this that the White Walkers are like, nope, we're taking them out, and that's the, like, what if it was that? I
understand, yeah. That could be the thing, because clearly they're existing and they're doing something. I mean, obviously they're taking offerings from Craster, right? Like, that is still, to me, of all of the things we see,
so weird.
That is the craziest thing in both the show and the books, is that the White Walkers are taking offerings from Craster in the form of these children. Clearly something had to happen for him to do it. Maybe it was just originally he didn't want any male kids because he's just a weirdo and he wants to have all of his daughter or wives, whatever. I mean, obviously that's weird. And so he just was like, you know, he just took the babies and he took them out there, right? Because just to die, which, I mean, is a terrible thing to do. But I mean, you know, like, you could see, like, you could just see it as that. It's like, nope, just take it out there and get rid of it. Like, I don't want to. So, and then maybe the White Walker started taking it and he realized, oh, I haven't, like, been accosted by, you know, wildlings, or
like, he stumbled on, is what you're saying.
He stumbles into seeing, oh, this is keeping them at bay. And then they start to hear rumors and stuff like that. And in his little camp, maybe somebody sees one at some point, and so they realize, they say, oh, they're taking them at night. Like, that's what's happening. And then that's the way it did it. Otherwise, there's something where, is there a deal made? I mean, it's crazy.
They can be bartered with. That's huge.
Right. I mean, because somehow, whether it's just he stumbles into it, or I don't think he has a conversation with them, but you know what I mean? Like, something happens to where he decides to do that, and then the White Walkers decide to take it and not just go kill them all or take them all. Or, you know what I mean? So clearly the White Walkers, on at least, view Craster as, we're going to let him keep doing this, whether they view it as a sacrifice or a tribute or whatever.
Yeah. And clearly there's an expectation there, and that they have come, whether or not Craster's aware, he is now in an agreement with these things. So,
right.
I mean, who's to say that they don't have all these, like, you know, cultures and rules and, ceremonies or whatever. And who knows, maybe the free folk, crack open a grave and they look at this and they're like, this was our former, you know what I'm saying? Like, it could be that big.
It's sacred ground to them.
Yes. And that's totally feasible. That is totally feasible to us. So I think that this is so interesting. And at the very least, we can think, okay, We are looking for a catalyst for why magic entered the world. Why did the White Walker start marching? Why are dragons existing? Why does R'hllor seem like he's legitimate? The House of Black and White is doing all this thing. Magic is re-entering the world of A Song of Ice and Fire. Could it be that when they cracked these graves, this was the reason?
Well, you know, a big theory in the show, remember, I mean, you go back to before season 8, everyone was speculating that, and I agree with you, it could be that they cracked the graves, and that could be the thing, because clearly the White Walkers decide, like, now's the time.
Yes.
And this seems like the worst time to do it, because dragons are coming back, which seemed to be the thing that could, like, eliminate them. But, yeah, you know, but yeah, so clearly the White Walkers do it. But for a long time, remember, everybody thought going into season 8, and we still don't know in the books. And again, White Walkers, Night King doesn't exist different. In the books. Right. Very different. But for the longest time, everybody thought it was the baby. It was Sam's baby, Sam and Gilly's. Well, I mean, really, it's Gilly's baby, but they named that. Everybody thought that was the thing. Remember, everybody thought them not giving that baby to the White Walker that it was probably expecting was like the thing that everyone was like, oh no, that's the trigger.
So literally they're just like, well, we must go get baby, therefore we march south. Like,
yeah,
like,
remember, everybody thought there was some sort of connection to it. Now in the books, there is a big difference between those babies, because those babies have been switched.
It's so much more interesting in the book. It's so cool. Yeah. It's so
big difference, because Sam and Gilly's baby is, what's that, Castle Black with,
it's Mance Raider's kid in quotes. Yeah. Like,
right. Flip. But Mance Raider's actual kid is with Gilly and Sam.
The heir to the king beyond the wall. I mean, dude, oh God, I want the next book so bad.
I know. But there is, and that's the thing. There's so many moving pieces, and there's so many ways you could go with it, which is probably why it's taken George R. R. Martin as long as it has to finish it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, I will say that he has not posted. This is one of the longest stretches he's gone without posting on Not a Blog.
I'll tell you this. Unfortunately,
not saying,
his last update was depressing as hell. So I'm not optimistic right now. He kind of said, nothing I've ever done in my life has mattered. Which, hey, George, you just like me for real. I feel that every day.
Hey, man, he hasn't posted since February 6th. Normally, he posts about every week.
Let me just. I just want to say something about George R. R. Martin real quick. And I was thinking about this today because, you know, I read a lot, and actually George R. R. Martin's the reason why I started reading so much again. And I am in debt to him beyond belief for writing these books, not just because of this awesome podcast, but because it sent me down a path where I'm so passionate about reading and literacy and connecting with people online. And it turned out to be a YouTube channel now that I have millions of views on people just want to talk about fantasy books. I mean, how cool is that? But the thing I like about George R. R. Martin, because I see a lot of people in the space, like a lot of authors. And the one thing I can say about George R. R. Martin, it never felt like he ever bought into his own hype. Yeah. If you read his blog, he's constantly dogging himself. He is constantly upset with himself. And I can relate to that so very much. I'm like, man, you know what? I also don't believe in myself. Like, it doesn't feel like he's very arrogant. Which is one of the reasons why I think his characters come off relatable as well, because anyone that's super duper arrogant as Song of Ice Fire, minus Jamie, generally unlikable, right? Our characters have doubts about themselves. They wonder their place in the world. John's a fantastic example of this. You know, I just, I love George. I wanted to put that out there. George, I know
you're big fan of the show. Yeah. I hope he does. I hope he does. Because we're never, like, I never get tired of these books. I have like ADHD, you know, whatever. I get tired of things all the time, but I never get tired of
them. Well, you're big into the superhero thing, right? And you know the big superhero things. What if? What if this? What if that? I've never liked that for anything, even stuff I've been really into. This is the only thing where I find alternate branches of what could have happened interesting.
I know. Well, or and then like potential ties to things. Like literally as you're reading this, I'm like looking at the chapter here. And you know, you literally read this to me and you were saying, hey, like this is awesome. This is what you took out of it, right? Was you were saying this line right here. Can you feel how cold it is? It's made of ice, John pointed out. You know nothing, John Snow. This wall is made of blood. Now had it drunk, it's filled. And actually, I was kind of thinking of two different things here. one, maybe the wall's magical properties does come from, as we were talking about, blood magic, like people who try to climb it and die, and like it sort of, you know, absorbs it or whatever. Oh. Other people think that there is quite literally an ice dragon in the wall, and that's what's giving it its magical powers as well. But I like both. But I do like this line here. It's made of ice, John pointed out. You know nothing, John Snow. This wall is made of blood. Well, I mean, just the idea of like Starks and winter, and John saying, oh, it's ice, and Egret saying, you know nothing, this wall is made of blood, which, if you want to talk about John's character, does potentially, you know, that is a fun little way to do a line there. John saying, oh, it's ice, and Egret saying it's blood, because what is the Targaryen phrase? Fire and blood. Yeah,
I like it. Because he thinks he's made of ice, which he's half right. He's half right. He is,
but fire and blood would technically be his house.
Yes, name. And also just it's interesting that John is so sure of his parentage and of him being a bastard. He's also so sure of what the wall is made. And I know she says it a lot, but it really does show that Jon Snow really does not know anything.
He does not.
He only knows what's been told to him.
Yeah. You know, we talked about this last time about like alternate universes and things. And like last time we did a John chapter, it was like two or three ago. But, you know, there are a lot of good things that the show did in terms of like, you know, when you think about characters and stuff like that, like, you know, the fact that Kit Harington, and I always forget her name, but the woman who plays Egret in the show, that they're literally married in real life.
Yeah, and also like royalty, like they both come from like royal heritage.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's like
so in a, you know, it does kind of make the somberness of their thing a little. What is her name? It's like Rose. I always forget.
Rose McGowan or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
And their chemistry on screen is fantastic.
Oh, it's so good. It's the fact that they're still married. You know, so many celebrity couples, especially like they did a big thing together, and then of course. So that's great. And then, you know, you look at like Sansa, loses Nymeria right out of the, or not Nymeria, Lady, right out of the gate, essentially. But Sophie Turner actually kept that dog.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. No, she kept. Yeah. That's her dog, man.
Oh God.
Isn't it great? You know, that's
so good, man. You know, I know that we're just gushing like, hey, you know what, man, this is a great show.
It's great. You
know? Yeah. We're just happy to be here talking about this. But you know, for the show having the ending it did, I get pretty much just warm feelings thinking about it. And I'm also just super thankful for the casting. Like so many people did such an amazing job, like career performances. And I'm always happy when I see them having like doing well, right? Like I know Kit Harington went to rehab and he had some issues, but it really seemed like, you know, he was able to stick out his marriage, which is amazing. And she supported him and he made it through. And I don't know. I feel like almost a not a parasocial type of relationship, but I feel an appreciation for the people who made the show as great as they did.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I know. Man. All right, guys. Well, with that, I think that's probably a good place to end this chapter. Very short chapter, like we said.
But good stuff there.
Yeah, very good stuff here. So let me think about this. So we are doing one more chapter and then we're diving in to the
So I'm going to be gone in 2 weeks, right? I'm going to be gone in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I keep thinking you're gone next week, but you're not.
Next week we can do another chapter and news.
Okay.
And then I like how we're planning this like literally on the podcast, but just so people know what's coming. 2 weeks, I'll be gone. So whether or not you want to do an episode, you know, it's up
to you. I'm going to do a big like Ravens episode. Cause we have a ton of comments on TikTok and stuff like that. A bunch of theories people have asked. So I think it would be kind of easy to just hammer out.
Great idea. So then when I return, probably what, the last week of March, then we will
right
in the House of the Dragon rewatch.
Exactly. And then of course in April, my schedule is completely up in the air because I'm supposed to have a kid, you know? So I guess that might throw a wrench in my plans.
The success of the podcast. Is
exactly. Yep. So that might throw a wrench in my plans as well. So, all right. Well, guys, with that, then we would like to thank you for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, we will be discussing A Storm of Swords, Jaime 4.
And if you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com or bendtheneepodcast.com.
All right, we will see you next time. And remember that winter is coming.